Unlock the power of your mind. This is Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor.
Welcome to another hour dedicated to a fresh inquiry exploring exactly what enlightenment means and what it is to be enlightened. Indeed, an hour devoted to learning something more about ourselves, an hour designed to help us integrate all of our knowledge and perhaps even challenge some of our ideas about the world we live in and the people we may have become. This is an hour for the open-minded, willing to risk their foregone conclusions and perhaps discover an entirely new dimension in their thoughts and being. I'm Eldon Taylor, and this is Provocative Enlightenment. All right, our chat room is open, and my partner Ravinder is there now. You can log on by going to eldontaylor.com/chat. That's eldontaylor.com/chat. Ravinder will see that your comments and questions do get on the air. Don't miss the chat room. Often our guests visit there during the show, and they take questions. What's more, we also show films that typically will give you a picture. Here it is, a motion action film of our guests. And today's no exception to that. So, Ravinder, you're up. Say hello to everyone and share your message of the day.
Hi, everyone. Do come join me in the chat room. I know I say the same thing every time, so I probably sound like a parrot, but we have lots of fun in there, and we'd love for you to come in and join us. We also make things a lot simpler there, so any URLs or links or any other information that the guests may give out, we also have posted right under the chat box, so you don't have to quickly grab your pen and paper. Just come to the chat room, join the chat, and learn some more.
Great. All right, every week I read some of your letters as our way of honoring the role you play in making our show successful. Last week, our show was all about animals and the afterlife, and our guest Kim Sheridan shared some stories with us that were nothing short of inspirational. John wrote, "Eldon, I must tell you that I really enjoyed the radio show today, but too bad you didn't have more time for your own experiences. I read your animal stories in your book. What does that mean? I was an avid hunter until I read the book. Now I have a different view of it all. Thank you." Liz wrote, "Listening to your show right now, and in the past, I have seen pets take on illnesses of their owners. I feel they take it on to protect their owners. I remember being told that when I was a lot younger, but over the years it seems to play out. A friend of mine has a little sweet poodle and was diagnosed with pancreatitis. When my friend told me, I suggested she might want to get checked, and sure enough, she had it too. The doc was surprised. She wanted to be checked, and there you go." Elaine wrote, "It was another great show, Eldon. So much to cover and so much to explore. I always get into conversations with myself about what it is to be human on Earth in terms of what is nature and instinct versus what is conscious choice, something the guests brought up as a part of our evolving. I thought you made a great point that needed to be made about animals killing other animals as part of their nature and even torturing them, as in cats with mice. I think of the plains tribes of North America and the other cultures and how we do engage in taking life in order to be sustained. And that it is a harsh world out there. We must build shelter to survive, etc. So talking about animals and soul presence and existence and meaning is loaded with all kinds of questions." Well, amen to that, Elaine. You'll like this one, Rav. Jen commented, "Honestly, I just want to say a heartfelt, I love this chat room. I have visited another chat room and I feel so welcomed here, where I didn't even know if they knew I was in the other one." What do you have to say about that, Rav?
We have an amazing chat room. That's, you know, there isn't any more than that. We have a great group of people. Everyone shares stories. They give answers. There's a whole lot that goes on there. If you're not in there, you're missing out.
Okay, I don't know about the room, but you do have a great group of people that make that chat room out. Yeah.
Fabulous.
Okay, well, I've got another one for you. How about this one? Isha added, "I communicated with Jessica, Ravinder's dog. I swear I did. The first day of my visit, she hated me. The last day, she didn't want to say goodbye."
That's adorable. And Carla still misses Isha.
She does?
Of course.
All right. Well, Isha ought to feel good about that. Isha, you should let the audience know is
my niece. My right. wonderful, wonderful niece, yes.
Lives in
and
the
she's
United
often
Kingdom.
In the chat room, too. Yeah. So.
All right. Carla wrote, an hour after my dad died in another state, a falcon joined me on my run, flying horizontally with me for several minutes. Falcons normally don't do this. I knew that it was my dad, as his favorite thing to do was fly his plane. Andrada wrote, thank you so much. I love your show. Well, we love that you love it. That was a nice, pithy comment. Now, 2 weeks ago, we discussed The Secret, and last week we read letters about the show. This letter from Mary Ellen came in about those letters. Hello, Eldon. Thanks for your good work. I listen to your radio show in the archives every week. I have been on a spiritual path for over 30 years. I am grateful for my journey, but I have to say that the journey has not always been about getting what I want. In fact, the journey has been about surrendering my own control to who, what, comes into my life. I think it is simply another manifestation of the consumer mentality that has plagued the United States for so many years. We all want what we want, when we want it, and we don't care how we treat others to get what we want. In my mind, the secret is just another way to make sure we get what we want. Now we can create what we want without even working for it. All we have to do is think about it. I know that many people are proponents of this way of thinking, and I do not judge them. I am very open-minded. I love physics, and I love reality. To me, spirituality is not about belief. It's about discovering what is true. I love that sentence. I can believe lots of things that simply do not make sense. The search for human beings is to discover what is true. I'll continue to listen to your show. I think you show respect for your good guests in your own way. More power to you, Eldon, and my best to Ravinder. Well, thank you, Mary Ellen, for your well-thought-out feedback and continued support. I like that letter. I think she says that very well. What do you think?
I think that's great. It's right on.
From Mexico, Dr. Barron wrote, Dear Dr. Eldon, I keep working with my patient who has lymphoma. He is very recovered and very filled with enthusiasm so far that he says sometimes he forgets he had cancer. He gave to me his testimony. Thanks to you for opening another door with your CDs to work with our mind. Well, thank you, Dr. Barron, for your feedback. And give your patient my best, for he has just provided me with another warm fuzzy. Finally, Angie wrote, thank you for the free programs on your website. The forgiveness one helped me a lot in particular. I was able to totally forgive someone who hurt me very deeply. You're more than welcome, Angie, and let me use your letter to remind everyone that we have a number of InterTalk programs available at absolutely no cost, including our cancer remission program. Albeit, we do need a note for this one from your healthcare professional indicating that you are receiving care. We don't want it used as a substitute for care. We think of this as just a part of our own Pay It Forward program. You can get yours by going to InterTalk, InterTalk.com, and selecting free programs from the left-hand navigation pane. All right, that's all the time we're going to take for letters, but I do invite you to opine by sending your email to Eldon at EldonTaylor.com or by joining me on Facebook. You can also just leave comments on my website. I do try to read all of your letters. Obviously, we can't get them all in the air, but they do impact our programming. I highly value your input, and I do encourage you to please provide your feedback. And once again, thank you for your continued support. Now to today's show. Dogs that know when their owners are coming home and other unexplained powers of animals. Talk about dovetail into last week's show. Our guest today believes that the telepathy between pets and humans, or between flocks of birds or schools of fish that move as a single organism, can be explained. You know, years ago I read Julian Jayne's book, The Origin of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind. I was so impressed with these theories that not only did I find myself quoting them in my own work, but I had to phone him at Princeton and have a chat. The bottom line, is it possible that at one time in our human history, we relied upon something like telepathy for communication instead of formal language? Jayne believes so, and he might even assert that just as flocks organize today, humans may have organized their shared social needs, requirements in the same way at some point in our past. There are many that discount animal intelligence altogether. Some still scoff at the idea that a bottlenose dolphin may suffer something like post-traumatic stress syndrome when their combat duties with the Navy end. There tends to be a need to diminish the intelligence and the emotional side of non-human animals, and I suspect that that is because of how we use animals. Whether it's for food or for research, our human rationalization process finds clever ways to ignore what one might otherwise think of as daily animal atrocities. Yet in the midst of all of that, we have good research going on by solid scientists that not only addresses animal IQ, but EQ as well. And when I say animal, I mean non-human animals. But they also investigate the so-called paranormal with inquiries into such things as NDEs and telepathy. Indeed, right here on this show, we had Dr. Kevin Nelson inform us that according to MRI research, critical areas of the brain that are involved during a human NDE are also involved during a non-human animal NDE. Just this past Sunday, I posted a new study on my Facebook page that demonstrated that monkeys, like humans, also reason through analogy. All right. When I think of major contributions to our understanding of the world we live in during my lifetime, one of the people that leaps to the front of the line is our special guest today, and I'm speaking of Dr. Rupert Sheldrake. He's been with us before, but in the event you missed him, Dr. Sheldrake is a biologist and author of more than 80 scientific papers and nearly a dozen books. A former research fellow of the Royal Society, he studied natural sciences at Cambridge University, where he was a scholar of Clare College, took a double first-class honors degree, and was awarded the University Botany Prize. He then studied philosophy at Harvard University, where he was a Frank Knox Fellow, before returning to Cambridge, where he took a Ph.D. in biochemistry. He was a fellow of Clare College, Cambridge University, where he carried out research on the development of plants and the aging of cells. At Clare College, he was also director of studies in biochemistry and cell biology. Dr. Sheldrake's work is expansive, but today we'll be talking about his book, the new fully updated and revised release of Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home and Other Unexplained Powers of Animals. This is a great read, a great book, so let's get Dr. Sheldrake in here. Welcome to Provocative Enlightenment, Dr. Rupert Sheldrake.
Hello, very good to be with you.
It's good to have you, sir. All we need is a band, an applause or something, you know, as the cue, so you know, okay, yeah, it's your time to come on the show, right?
Mm-hmm.
Most people who have heard of you would think of morphic resonance. How did you go from that to animal powers? In other words, how did you become interested in animal powers?
Well, I've always been interested in animal powers, actually. When I was a child, I kept a lot of pets. Jackdaws, pigeons, dog, budgerigar, fish. I had a rabbit. I had a lot of animals, and I think what fascinated me most as a child was how homing pigeons home, because I had pigeons that homed, and I got interested in local pigeon racing people. And so, actually, I've always been fascinated by animals, and the fact that much of my research career was on plants was partly because I liked animals so much. If you do research on animals in modern universities, you spend most of your time killing them or tormenting them in one way or another. I just didn't want to do that. So I worked on plants. And then I came back to animals when I discovered that you could do really interesting research in a non-invasive way. And my work on morphic fields led me to believe that that telepathy between animals was a normal feature of animal social groups. I came to this conclusion because the idea of morphic fields is that every organized system has an organizing field. So a flock of birds, a school of fish, a pack of wolves have a field that links the members together. It's another way of saying they're bonded to each other. And when they're separate, when they're apart, maybe miles apart, this field continues to connect them and acts as a channel through which telepathic communications can pass. So that's why I got interested in animal telepathy. And I remembered I'd heard many stories from people about it. I had my own experiences, and I wanted to see if there was something really happening here. So that led me into what turned out to be a long series of researches, which are summarized in this book, Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home.
Okay, Dr. Sheldrick, you heard the setup piece, and let's go to something that you say in your book, because Julian Jaynes has this idea, and I'm not sure if you've read his work, but I'm assuming his idea and has something to do with what you meant by this, and I'm just going to quote this line out of your book. This is a book of recognition. Recognition that animals have abilities that we have lost. Please flesh that idea out. Explain what you mean by abilities we have lost.
Well, I think that in my book, the three kinds of powers of animals I discuss are telepathy, the sense of direction, and premonitions. And in every one of those respects, animals seem to be much better than humans. We have the same kinds of abilities, but usually animals have them better developed. For example, in telepathy, many dogs know when their owners are coming home. They pick up their intention. I've shown by numerous experiments that it's not just routine. It's not just hearing familiar car sounds. They can. We film the dogs. We've got good evidence they really do anticipate their owners' arrivals. They're much more sensitive than people. Some people can do the same kind of thing, but not as many and not as well. And then if you take the sense of direction, some humans have a fairly good sense of direction, especially traditional people like Polynesian navigators or Native Americans or Australian Aborigines. But most modern people don't have a very good sense of direction. They rely on GPS systems and so forth. But homing pigeons can be taken 600 miles from their home into a completely unfamiliar place, released in the morning, and they get home within the same day if it's in the summer. No human could do that. I mean, they couldn't find their home from an unknown place from miles away. And animals can also have abilities to anticipate disasters like earthquakes and tsunamis. A lot of evidence that animals anticipate those, and I've documented it in my book from quite a number of tsunamis and earthquakes, as well as avalanches and so on. And animals are much better at that than people. So I'm not saying that we don't have these abilities. I'm saying that we still have them, and some people have them more than others. But basically, we've lost a lot of that ability that many animals still have.
Okay, to the point, I guess, do you believe there was ever a time in the human evolution that human beings, whatever stage of Homo erectus, Homo epithecus, etc., we might have been at, that as opposed to formal language, we communicated telepathically?
Well, yes, I think that's quite plausible. I mean, not necessarily with the full range of information we communicate now. Most
right.
Telepathic communication that I've studied is pretty basic things, like, I want to talk to you, I need help, come here, I'm in pain or distress, I'm dying. You know, it's about very basic emotional messages. It's not like complex, kind of information you'd get in a reference book or an encyclopedia. It doesn't deal with that kind of information, usually.
Or one of your lectures.
Or one of my lectures. So we need language for this very differentiated and complex form of communication. But for the most basic messages, come here, I need you, that kind of thing, I think humans, like animals, not only did do that, I think they still do. And these abilities are better developed among non-industrial people. I mean, they seem to be commoner in places like Africa and India than they are in the modern Western world. But even in the modern Western world, telepathy has evolved along with technology, so that the commonest kind that now happens is telephone telepathy, where people think of someone who then calls. And then when the person calls, they say, it's funny, I was just thinking about you. that's extremely common. More than 80% of people have had that experience. And right. I've done a lot of research on that as well that shows that this is not just coincidence, not just guessing. There's something really going on.
All right. Now, your work is somewhat controversial with some in mainstream science. And, we're going to flesh that out a little bit because, actually, I think referring to them as members of mainstream science does science a disservice. But that's my personal view. Still, that's it. Your work has riled the likes of Richard Dawkins and P.Z. Myers. It's just a case in point. Indeed, Myers stated that your research and work, and I quote, are exercises in gullibility, anecdote, and sloppy statistics. You can't just simply carry out a Fortean exercise in collecting odd anecdotes and unexplained phenomena. So I have two questions for you, Dr. Sheldrake. First, how do you answer your critics? And I know you've got a good deal in your book, so cover that, please. But more importantly, how does this kind of nonsense influence you personally?
Well, I mean, to come to the second point first, sometimes I get really angry when people make ignorant, uninformed comments of the kind that Myers does. I mean, it's not as if he's actually studied the evidence. He wouldn't say that if he had. So sometimes I get really angry, but usually it doesn't last long, and I try not to bear resentment, and I think anger is a destructive emotion, so certainly not something I cherish or encourage, but I can't help it flaring up when I read some particularly bigoted statement. But what I've come to see is that through long experience of dealing with skeptics, and as you say, I document my dealings with them and the controversies in this new edition of my book, including Richard Dawkins and many of the leading skeptics, Michael Shermer. What I've found in talking to them is that almost uniformly, they're simply not interested in the evidence. They think they know the truth already. In other words, we're not dealing with real science here. We're dealing with a form of dogmatism, a belief system, which is a particularly narrow and strident one. In fact, it's a kind of scientific fundamentalism. And I don't like fundamentalisms of any kind. But scientific fundamentalism, I think, is worse than other forms because at least religious fundamentalists know that what they're talking about is a belief, whereas scientific fundamentalists don't realize they're just talking about a belief system. They think they're talking about the truth and that they know the truth and other people don't. They think everyone else has beliefs, but they know the truth. And that's particularly annoying because it's hypocritical. But I've come to see that this is a worldview. It's something a lot of people have. A lot of people share that attitude. And when they attack my work, they're attacking it because basically they need to. They can't admit that anything like telepathy exists because it would too much destroy their belief system, which doesn't allow anything like telepathy to happen. They believe the mind is nothing but the brain confined to the inside of the head, and therefore telepathy couldn't possibly happen. Intentions couldn't have effects at a distance. So really, I see them as believers defending a belief system. Then I don't feel as angry about it. I don't take it personally. It's not a personal attack on me. It's simply people having to defend a worldview. And many of them feel rather under attack, and they have a kind of entrenched attitude. I think possibly because they realize that the days of materialism are numbered.
You know, I want to take that up, the mechanistic view, after a break, but we've got a hard break coming here. In just a few seconds, I guess, so I want to know, do you ever feel discouraged in the face of that kind of onslaught?
Sometimes I do, because I feel that it's hard to get my own view across through the media, because the skeptics, the so-called skeptics, get preferential
dominate
treatment.
It, right.
Yeah.
All right, well, we do have this hard break. We'll pick this up when we come back, Dr. Sheldrake. You're listening to Provocative Enlightenment on Hay House Radio. We're talking with Dr. Rupert Sheldrake about his research and wonderful book, Dogs That Know When Your Owners Are Coming Home. We have links on our website. You can find it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and I'm sure any brick-and-mortar store. If you're not already in our chat room, now's a great time to join in the conversation. Just go to eldentaylor.com/chat. Stay with us during the break. You won't want to miss what's coming up in the next half of the show. And be sure to catch the film, Dr. Sheldrake, in our chat room. We'll be right back after these words from some of our friends.
Unlock the power of your mind. This is Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor.
Welcome back. If you just joined us, we're speaking with Dr. Rupert Sheldrake about his research and delightful book, Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home. But before we get back to today's show, I want to invite you to join me in Pasadena on Saturday, October 15th, for the ICANN conference. Let me know, that you listen to Hay House Radio, listen to this show, and I have a special gift for you. So, find me, come tell me. I guarantee you'll want the gift. You can get all the details right here on hayhouse.com. Okay, I would also like to invite you to join me on Facebook and or follow me on Twitter. If you like our show, do spread the word. We genuinely appreciate your support. Now, before we went to the break, we were discussing with Dr. Rupert Sheldrake the mechanistic perspective that seems to dominate not just a large part of science today, but dominate the media, and how difficult it is to break through that. Well, I don't want to call it I guess it is a paradigm. At any rate, Dr. Sheldrake, the mechanistic view of life versus your view. Your view as a scientist and from your own personal observations as a member of the human race. How do they differ and why?
Well, I think the main difference is that the mechanistic view takes the machine as its principal metaphor. That's why it's called the mechanistic view. It says that everything in nature is essentially mechanical. The universe is a mechanism. Animals and plants are basically machines. Humans are just machines, the heart's a pump, the brain's a computer, the eye's like a camera, etc. It takes this machine metaphor everywhere. Well, I think this is extremely anthropocentric. It's only humans that make machines, and only modern humans come to that. And it projects an obsession with machinery that's part of industrial modern society onto the whole of nature. It's extremely inappropriate, and I think it's much more appropriate to think of nature as organic. I think living organisms are living organisms. That's essentially what I think, and I think most people think that too. Even most mechanists, even most believers in the mechanistic worldview, don't really believe it all the time. They believe it when they're at work, but as soon as they go home, they don't treat their partners and their children and their pet dogs as mere machines. They revert to being normal people. With real relationships, and many of them are great nature lovers when they're off duty. They like hiking and going to national parks and things. So off duty, most mechanists are not mechanists. It's only on duty. It's a kind of intellectual uniform they put on.
Now, just to be the devil's advocate, because I have squared off with some of these people myself, the proponents of the meat machine model would argue that there is nothing inconsistent about recognizing the nature of our relationships and the good feelings that we have from compassion and love and empathy, that is just built into the machine, that is one of the marvels of the machine, as opposed to draw the dichotomy that you can't have the machine and also have these emotional feelings.
Well, you see, that just shows how far credulity can go. I mean, they have a commitment to this machine view. Human beings with all these emotions, compassion, etc., are nothing like any machines we actually know. I mean, computers don't have compassion. They're really good at computing, but they don't have emotions or compassion. And what they then say is, oh, well, that's because we haven't yet made machines that are human-like. Right. We're working on it, and eventually we'll have machines that do have these properties, proving machines can be like that. And the problem with that line of argument is essentially it's an act of faith. As the philosopher of science, Sir Karl Popper, put it, materialism is based on issuing promissory notes for explanations that don't yet exist. And what's more, they're undated promissory notes. So the what they do is say, well, we haven't yet figured out how to explain consciousness and all these things, but we're going to make machines that will have these properties, and then we'll prove to everybody that we really are just machines. So it's essentially an act of faith. It's a faith possession. It's not a logical, evidence-based point of view. It's a commitment to a belief that isn't yet proved by science, I think never will be, but they totally believe at some stage in the future, 100 years, maybe 200 years, it'll all be proved. So that's, it is essentially faith, and you can't really argue with faith.
You know, the next thing that they will say is, of course, you know, relevant to my next question. All right. What do you then say when they insist on replication as a gold standard in science?
Well, I agree with that. And that's why, you know, I replicate my own experiments often. I try and encourage others to do them. My work on dogs, knowing when their owners have come home, has been replicated by a skeptic. My work on telephone telepathy has been replicated in at the University of Amsterdam, the University of Freiburg. I'm currently working with one of Britain's leading skeptics, Professor Chris French, on replicating it in his laboratory. So those experiments are still in process. But, you know, I'm all in favor of replication, and I think a lot of this research has already been replicated. But although skeptics may say, we want all this replication, the fact is that it doesn't matter if you replicate it or not. I haven't met a skeptic yet who's read my original papers on this or any of the replications. It's just a kind of carping criticism. The replications are already there. I agree with the demand for replication, but for those who say we won't believe it till it's been replicated, really what they're saying is we won't believe it because much of it has already been replicated.
Right. It just hasn't been replicated in the way they want or in the order, or they move to some nomological deductive model where they expect that the law that you're going to operate from is as definitive as, say, the law of gravity. All right. Let me ask you this. Let's go to your book. How many animals do you believe, animal species, are telepathic? All of them?
Well, I couldn't say that because I've only studied a small number. But I've looked at telepathy mainly in domesticated animals because that's the easiest to investigate. After all, we live with them and we can observe them on a regular basis. So the dogs that dogs are one. There are many examples of telepathy with dogs, cats, parrots, horses, sheep kept as pets, as lambs. Then the examples of parrots, parakeets, minor birds. Almost all the examples that I've got, I've got about 27 species that have shown evidence of being telepathic with humans. They're all mammals and birds. There's very little convincing evidence for telepathy in snakes. I've got one or two examples of snakes and other reptiles that may be telepathic, but they're few and far between. And reptiles are usually solitary, even with each other. They're not social animals. And telepathy, I think, is a product of being of social bonds. And I don't know whether fish are telepathic with each other or not. I think, in a sense, they are, because when they swim in shoals or schools, the way in which their behavior is coordinated so they can change direction without bumping into each other is a kind of field-like phenomenon, which is a bit like telepathy, in this case not telepathy at a distance, but telepathy close by. They know not only where the others are moving, but where they're going to move. And so when they move, they change direction very fast without bumping into other fish. So I don't know. I think that in my book, Seven Experiments That Could Change the World, I consider the possibility that social insects, ants, bees, termites, and wasps, may be telepathic with each other. They communicate. They certainly communicate through smell, through touch. But there are some cases of activity in social insects that suggest there's more than that going on. So I think telepathy may be very widespread in social animals, including insects. But this is a, because this is a taboo topic within science, there's been very little research. And so it's hard to know. We're still at a very underdeveloped stage of science in these areas. And when the taboo dissolves, as I'm sure it will sooner or later, this would be a fascinating topic for research. And a lot of people will be able to open up, these fields of research. It will be like whole new areas to open up for science that have been closed for a long time. You know, it's as if these whole areas are under a kind of embargo, like Cuba.
Well, okay, now listen, when you say research, what I want to do, I guess, is get clear in everybody's mind that what you do isn't just anecdotal information like stories told by owners or trainers or, you know, I think common sense is still, in my view, a gold standard of knowledge. But it's much more than that. So explain to our audience how you set up your experimental trials and how you verify the activities that you actually research.
Well, I could explain it. Do you want me to do it with the telephone tests or the dog tests? I could do it with either.
Either way, just so that everybody gets a complete view that this is a scientific study. This isn't just anecdotal information.
Okay. Well, let's take the dogs. What we do is we find people who say their dogs know when they're coming home and do it quite regularly. And we ask them to keep a log so that we've got a written record of how often they do this. And when we find dogs that do that quite reliably, what we then do is we set up cameras in the person's house, so a camera pointing at the door or wherever the dog waits. And we have that running, doing time-coded filming, the whole time the person is away from home. They go at least 5 miles away. Then we pick a time at random, using random number tables, for them to come home. They don't know in advance when they're coming home. When that randomly time comes up, we let them know by a telephone pager, it's time to go home now. So they get the message to go home. They set off home. And to avoid the dog picking up any familiar car sounds, we have them come home in unfamiliar vehicles or taxis. And they're at least 5 miles away. Then from the footage, when they get home, we look at the films of all these experiments. We get people to look at them who know nothing about the experiment. So what they do is simply write down what they see on the screen, when the dog goes to the door or the window, the exact time, how long it stays there. It's an objective record, and different people can look at the same thing. They get exactly the same results. It's an objective fact. We then look at we then plot them on graphs and look at when the dog is waiting at the window in relation to when the person forms the intention to come home. And it turns out that these dogs don't go and wait at the window when they're not coming home, but they do when even at random times. When we tell them to come home at random times, they start waiting then. And they spend most of the time at the window when they're waiting, when the person's on the way home, and very little when they're not. In some experiments, for example, they go to the window or the door occasionally when the person's not coming home to respond to sounds from outside. On average, in our experiments, they'd be at the window or door about 4% of the time when the person's not coming home, and maybe 70-80% of the time when they are. There's a very clear statistical difference, and we can analyze all this statistically, and we can repeat it with different dogs and so forth. So this is a scientific experiment using objective methods of recording. This is not just anecdotes that may depend on people's faulty memory and that sort of thing.
Right, and something that, as you point out, your critics or the doubting Thomases or any other serious scientist can replicate easy enough because the protocol is an exacting protocol. It's an objective protocol. That's what I was looking for.
That's right.
Just move away from that for a second and just go to the common sense again. Now, farmers and ranchers, you know, often rely on their animals to foretell weather conditions. My horses, as a case in point, will run and kick and play hard before a storm. So I knew we were going to have a big rainstorm this morning. Just, you know, watching the horses went out to feed them. Cattlemen will tell you that, you know, If you're not sure about whether it's going to rain or not, look at the cows, you know. If they lay down, it isn't going to rain, and if they stand up, well, the rain is coming. So my question, in your research, are animals capable of foretelling the weather and other earth events like the earthquakes that you mentioned earlier?
Well, I don't have any doubt about the earthquakes because I've done, you know, all the main earthquakes in the last 20 or 30 years I've tried to monitor. To see whether there's animal warnings, and in almost every case there are. So I think it's pretty clear that animals can give warnings of earthquakes, hours, even days in advance. Now, I think they can also give warnings of changes in the weather, but that's not something I've actually documented in much detail because that would require, you know, it would be another detailed study. It's beyond what I can do at the moment. I mean, my feeling about the weather and animals is if I ran the world, what I'd do, or if I ran a media company or a TV or radio show, what I'd do is find people who think they can forecast the weather on the basis of animals or aching arthritic joints or whatever. You know, there's lots of ways people claim to be able to predict the weather. Mm-hmm. And as well as the regular official weather forecasts, here in Britain we have official weather forecasts from the Meteorological Office that go out on BBC Radio News. As well as the official weather forecast, I'd have an unofficial one based on a network of people communicating by phone or internet, based on animal signs and aching joints and that kind of thing. And at the end of each week or the end of each month, I'd have an assessment to find out who got it right more often. And I'd set up these unofficial methods, you know, and compare them with the official ones. The official ones are often wrong. It's not as if science always gets it right. They don't. And it may be that animals would be better at it. They've never been given a chance to be compared. And this way, I think this would be really fun as a media thing. It would be a fun media thing. Everyone would want to know whether the unofficial one would do better than the official one. And if it did, or if it did as well, then, you know, people would be more interested in taking seriously these things about horses and cows that have been known to country people for forever, probably.
Yeah, and that's a great idea, the media thing. How do you track animals with the earthquakes?
Well, I can't personally track them because, you know, you don't know when an earthquake is going to happen.
Right.
The whole point about earthquakes is they're unexpected. But what I do is collect reports on animal behavior before the earthquake. For example, in 1997, there was a big earthquake in Assisi, Italy. And I happened to have an Italian research assistant at the time. So I sent her over to Assisi a few days after the earthquake. And she was a journalist. And I asked her to go around and interview pet shop owners, vets, restaurant proprietors, the mayor, the city authorities, etc., and collect information on anything they'd noticed before the earthquake. It turned out that there'd been a lot of signs before the earthquake. Dogs had been howling in the night inexplicably for a couple of days in advance. And 4 or 5 days in advance, the mayor in Assisi and in nearby towns, these mayors had had complaints from restaurant proprietors and other tradesmen who dealt with the tourist trade, saying that rats had started coming out of their burrows and were running everywhere, and it was causing, you know, damage to their business because they wanted them to do something about all these rats. This was highly unusual. They don't normally do that. So when you actually look into what was going on, there's many examples of unusual animal behavior, both with domesticated and wild animals. And so that's how I've been documenting it, by collecting information on people's experience. And the Chinese,
and overall,
the Chinese actually do this systematically since 1975, and they take seriously animal warnings. They collect this information, and they're the only people who've ever been able to make successful predictions of earthquakes by listening to animals and by paying attention to these so-called unconventional signs.
Okay, we could spend the whole show on that, I mean, but there's a famous cat by the name of Oscar that seems to be able to predict when a person will die. When
yes.
he senses a patient's time is near, Oscar goes to the room, jumps on the bed, curls up next to the patient, and purrs, and that seems to, you know, make the patient feel better. Now, Oscar resides in Providence, Rhode Island, in a nursing home. Is this uncommon? I mean, can animals detect the health of a person, Dr. Sheldrake?
Oh, quite often, yes. I mean, Oscar is not unique. Oscar got a lot of publicity in the media, but I've been tracking this kind of behavior for quite a while, and people who work in hospices and so on had told me of other cats that do this kind of thing. And this can also be very useful. It's useful for people in hospices. It may not be so helpful for the person who's dying. I mean, they may see Oscar as an angel of death or something. But there are cases where animals can be really helpful with people's health, and the most spectacular are dogs that warn people of epileptic seizures. There are quite a lot of people who are epileptic. Some of them can have their seizures controlled by medication, but some can't. For ones who can't, when they don't know the fits are going to come on, it's a terrible burden for them, and they can't go out for fear of having a seizure in public and so on. But thousands of people around the world who are epileptic have dogs that warn them of these seizures, and the dog can do it up to half an hour in advance. It will sort of herd them into safety, sort of make sure they're sitting down or lying down, and then stand watch by them. Now, how these dogs know, they're very reliable. They've been investigated to a certain extent by vets and by medical people. They're very reliable. How they do it, nobody knows. So here's a case where animals foresee human health problems in a way that's really helpful. There are also dogs that can sniff cancer and diagnose cancer by sniffing people's skin or urine. They're actually used on a small scale already. I mean, I think animals could help us a lot more, but they don't fit into the high-tech, expensive medical model that we have at the moment. But I think they could be much more helpful. They're willing to help. It's just that we don't let them.
And or we might have to adjust how we see animals.
Yes.
Give them. All right. We're running short of time, but there's another, I think, very important question that I want to get into. I've got dozens of questions, but this one, because so far we've been talking about how animals read people telepathically, how animals can serve people. But, you know, in your book, you have a piece, you share a story of Diane Archangels, a friend of mine's been on the show a couple of times. There's a two-way street here. Human beings can be telepath or can receive the telepathic information from the animal as well. Is that correct? And I'm sorry, doctor, but we only have about 30 seconds.
Okay, yes, it is correct. But it doesn't happen as often as the other way around. Some people know when their dog or cat is sick or has had an accident. They feel it in their body usually, or they dream about it. Yes, so it does work the other way around, but animals are usually more sensitive than people, so it works more from us to them than them to us.
And that's a matter, I think, of openness, but we're out of time, and we're going to have you back. I want everybody to know how they can connect with you, perhaps even participate in some of your research, find your website, your book. So, you know, 15, 20 seconds, give us that information, please.
Okay. The key book we're talking about, Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home, in bookstores and on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. My website, www.sheldrake.org, S-H-E-L-D-R-A-K-E. A lot of information, including my published papers, information about my books, and how you can help with research. I've just launched in the U.S. a new telephone telepathy test that you do with mobile telephones. You just need two other people to help you. It's free.
Okay, we're out of time, Doctor. Is that on your website?
Yes,
everybody,
that's
go to
too.
The website. We've come to the end of another hour of Provocative Enlightenment. I thank you for being here. I hope you enjoyed our show. Until next time, remember, believing in yourself always matters.